Thank you. First of all, I've got to correct Mark. Of course, it will not be in two volumes, but three. One, two, and three. And I will read all three tonight. It's the first time that I speak here from this perspective, and it's very funny. It always almost reminds me of the clown theaters that we enjoyed when we were small kids in Germany. So there was always the clown popping in from the side. But as Mark said, that it doesn't hurt my credibility, because in any case, I don't have to advise you tonight how to invest your bucks, but can talk about lighter stuff. And my subject is Mises' courage in the face of calamity. Well, calamity had much to live through during his life. And what I will do is just to illustrate you how he reacted to calamity with three examples. Out of his life, one out of First World War, then another example of the immediate post-war period, 1919, and then another example, Mises faced through the Great Depression in 1931. And, well, all of this will illustrate that Mises' general attitude, well, to what life was, that he put that maxim in practice, that said, well, life is far too short in order not to do the things that you cherish most. And what he cherished most was, well, truth and liberty. And as you will see, well, he that's what he tried to achieve even when things got rough. So the first episode is in 1917. The Russian government had just been overthrown in a democratic revolution. Before, you had the evil Tsar. Now you get the nice democratic government, which made it possible for the Western allies finally, especially for the U.S. finally, to ally itself with Russia. So after the overthrow of the Kerensky government in 1917, the Bolsheviks called for an immediate end of the war on the East Front on a status quo ante basis and without restitutions on both sides. Moreover, they began to make public highly secret pre-war Western plans for dividing Germany in case of an Allied victory. These revelations increased the political pressure on the Allies to seek an early peace, as their causes for beginning the war now appeared in a decidedly less saintly light than before. The stark contrast between the evil Germanic autocrats and the humane democracies of the West faded away and was slowly replaced by a more realistic picture of the situation. But most of all, the Bolsheviks' push for peace changed the military situation, since it brought the prospect of relieving Austria and Germany from their awkward two-front struggle. But the Germans and the Austrians did not accept, but asked for high concessions on the Russian side. The German side insisted that war restitutions that the Bolsheviks could not accept. The peace negotiations started in Brest-Litovsk shortly before Christmas 1917, and were brought to an end only after an Austro-German ultimatum forced the Russian side to sign a treaty by which it ceded the military control of the entire Ukraine to its enemies. Thus, what initially promised to be a great military and political success of the German-Austrian side had turned into a disaster. But in any case, that was what was the situation. They got military control of the Ukraine. The official rationale for military occupation of Ukraine was the exploitation of its rich natural resources. Few people in Germany and Austria knew that this idea was flawed. Mises knew it. In his article on the goal of trade policy, which was published in 1916 during the war, and which, by the way, was another incident that brought him into trouble, because in this article he had already explained that there is no economic rationale for the extension of political borders. As a consequence, he was immediately sent back to the front. So in this article, he had pointed out that economic control over resources can be enjoyed even in the absence of political control over these resources. Access to Ukrainian resources would have been possible through regular trade channels and did not require military occupation of the entire country. Mises had relentlessly insisted on this point with an intransigence that almost cost him his life. The real economic rationale, so to say, for the occupation of the Ukraine was the usual one. It brought unearned riches to some elect few. In the present case, the economic exploitation of the occupied zone was to be confided to an Ostsyndikat, a cartel of big industrialists and big bankers with good government connections. Each of them would have the monopoly rights of dealing in certain Ukrainian products. A May 1918 meeting in Berlin brought all interested men together and determined the broad division of the loot, in particular each party's trade contingent, its exclusive trade domain. One of the unsettled questions after the Berlin meeting was the future monetary constitution of the Ukraine. The Austrian side had a special interest in the question because the war inflation had swept large quantities of Kronen, that was the Corona was the Austrian currency at the time, into the occupied zone. Decisions about Ukrainian money and currency would most certainly affect the demand for Kronen notes and thus could possibly break up the Kronen's fiat exchange rate. The fundamental problem was that Austria-Hungary, like all other warring states, had created a vast amount of inflation, which again and again led to decreases of the exchange rate of the krona with other currencies, which were less inflated. The only thorough way to stop both the inflation and its symptoms was, of course, to stop producing additional banknotes in the first place. However, many statists and money cranks sought to get around this dreadful measure by various tricks. One of these tricks was to make payments in money titles issued on behalf of other banks than the Austro-Hungarian Central Bank in Vienna. The Austrians applied this measure in the Italian territories that they had occupied. So maybe we will also soon see similar measures in the West, maybe Americans selling bonds denominated in the Afghanistan currency, whatever that is. They made payments to their Italian suppliers in Darlehenskassenscheine. No, I will not translate that. Denoted, well, in any case, it's a kind of a money substitute, right? Denoted in lira to bolster the krona exchange rate against the lira. Now, there's clearly no idea that these measures, all these measures, were entirely unfit to attain the end that they sought. Yet hardly anybody in Austria-Hungary was able to comprehend and still less to solve such problems. At some point in June 1918, a certain Otto Katz, or Otto the Cat, director of the Union Bank in Vienna, approached Mises on behalf of a financial policy mission to solve the currency problems of the Ukraine. Mises would become an important member of the group charged with monetary policy in this important occupied territory. The head of the group would be one Excellence Krauss, under whose leadership Mises had already fought the last battles of the Bukovina and the 12th Isonzo battle. The mission represented a great opportunity for Mises. Being 36 years old, captain of the Austrian army, he still had one of the lower officer ranks, and his position in civilian life was not very elevated either. His main capital was just the solid reputation he had gained as an expert in monetary economics. Katz's offer was therefore a unique career opportunity. At the very least, it promised exceptional exposure to high-profile policymaking. So essentially that kind of job that all Harvard and Yale graduates would be jumping for. There was nothing to do but to thank God, his fate, and Mr. Katz for the offer, and to accept it immediately and wholeheartedly. Characteristically, however, Mises spelled first out his conditions. He would offer his services for this venture only if he had full decision-making power. Being the officer with exclusive responsibility for the financial and monetary policy of the Ukraine, this required in turn that he be transferred into the civil service and obtain a position corresponding that of a Bosnian Secretary of State, whatever that is, but it's much higher up the ladder than he was. Most importantly, he demanded that his bureaucratic competences be completely clarified to avoid later frictions that would turn out to be harmful for the cause. Mises had no illusions about the acceptability of his proposals. Setting clear terms of cooperation in the interests of the cause was simply not the style of the Austrian administration, and he therefore thought the negotiations were at an end. But some days later, a high officer of the Generalstab, so the headquarters, military headquarters in Vienna, asked him to name the concrete conditions under which he would be willing to join the commander of the Second Army as a financial and monetary consultant. Mises suggested dividing the civil service of the Second Army's commander into three departments, one of which would be for him. Moreover, he required that he become a civil servant. He had to be a civil servant to have authority in dealing with the other representatives of the state. For the same reason, it would not be advisable for him to remain an officer of the Chamber of Commerce, for in his capacity as monetary officer, he would have to revise agreements between the Ukraine and the Austrian Appendix Organization of the Vienna Chamber of Commerce, which was formerly a part of the Trade Ministry and had a monopoly for Ukrainian imports and exports. His negotiations with the Bureau would stand in a bad light because the Bureau's executives had higher ranks than Mises. Moreover, these negotiations would risk inciting nationalist resentments since they could be depicted as an inner Austrian deal to the detriment of other nations. Becker, that was the responsible general, seemed to endorse Mises' arguments and restated them almost literally in an official recommendation to his superior. In this public paper, of which Mises received a copy, Becher suggested that Mises be invited to go to Odessa, the capital of Ukraine, for an oral presentation and also to study conditions in Kiev and other large Ukrainian towns. Behind the curtains of the general staff, however, plans were made to induce the recalcitrant captain to cooperation without giving in to his demands. In mid-July, the head of the War Ministry's department where he worked received order that he had to reduce his staff beyond the reduction that had initially been considered satisfactory. The order came from very high up in the hierarchy, and it was very specific about the staff members that he would be concerned. Mises was, of course, one of them. When he received the news from his boss, he knew the only choice left to him was between the front and a Ukrainian mission without conditions. His boss managed to extend Mises' vacation, which he spent in Bad Garstein. It's a very beautiful vacation resort in the Austrian Alps. And then the commander of the East Army, General Alfred Krauss, sent Mises on a two-week mission to Odessa and Kiev and ordered him to report about Ukrainian currency and finance. Mises arrived in Odessa on September 7, 1918, and very quickly found that the Germans were pushing for the establishment of a Ukrainian fractional reserve central bank, whereas the Austrians, in particular a certain Pollack from the Ministry of Finance and the Vienna Association of Bankers, resisted this plan. As things stood, it was politically inevitable that any monetary constitution for the Ukraine would have to involve a central bank with a monopoly of banknote issue. The question was whether the new establishment could be limited to the role of provider of currency, or whether it would also be drawn into solving the pressing financial problems of the country. The latter option was likely to jeopardize the stability of the new currency. Yet how could the financial burdens be shouldered without endangering the currency? Mises convinced the Austrian bankers to promote sales of Vienna stocks and bonds to the Ukrainian public. Rather than through inflation, as the Germans would have it, the Misesian strategy was to seek a private business solution through an increase of foreign holdings of Austrian stock and debts. Mises stayed for some more days in Odessa and then went briefly to Kiev before returning to Vienna on September 22nd. That was, by the way, 1 week before the revolution broke out within the Austrian Empire, and thereafter the war ended very quickly. In a short report to the general, he made comments and suggestions to make this proposed institution as good as possible. He recommended that the future central bank be built on the model of the Bank of the Russian Empire, because the Ukrainian merchants were used to dealing with the Russian central bank so that its model could be retained with a few modifications. Like its Russian model, the Ukrainian central bank should be a pure government institution, as distinct, for example, from the former setup of the Bank of England, and be endowed with an equity capital of 20 million karbovanych. I cannot tell you how much that is in dollars. I've not yet found the exchange rate of this currency. But in any case, you see that it's a typical feature of Mises' engagement in a public policy question that he was extremely well informed, not only about the technical possibilities, but also about the history of these countries. So he adopted a solution that would pose the least adjustment problems for the merchants involved. Right? They were used to dealing with a central bank built on the model of the Russian central bank, and so it should be a similar institution. In its investment policies, the new bank should follow banking principles, which meant, above all, no risky investments and no long-term engagements. Mises thus proposed a fractional reserve central banking system, better known as the gold exchange standard. He recommended keeping reserves for one-third of all circulating banknotes, and these reserves should be either in cash or in foreign currency. The management of the bank should, of course, be subordinate to the government, preferably to the trade minister, since the finance minister would be tempted to abuse it for fiscal purposes. So that was about the typical proposal of Mises from the time of his phase. Well, let's call it, he was more optimistic in government's ability to manage a currency than he would be later on. Of course, the proposals were never put into practice. A week after his return to Vienna, the Bulgarian front crumbled, and after another month, Austria, Hungary, and Germany were in a state of political and military dissolution. The war ended in sudden chaos. Now, but still, the incident shows how Mises had reacted to this situation of calamity, and characteristically, he did not, although that would have been the easier way out, either seek a higher position for himself, comfortable position for himself at the expense of the of more increased economic problems for the citizens of Ukraine, a country to which he had no personal emotional attachment. And he sought a solution that involved, well, private means, means typical for the for capitalism, rather than inflation in particular. Now, the next incident, is it 10 to 8?
10
minutes. 10 minutes. The next incident will be shift, will be avoided. Because we don't have enough time, yeah? Terrible, yeah? So there's the economics of...
Well, so the subject...
Oh, yeah. Now, that you bring me to it. Now, the thing here was, 1919... Well, anyway, I will read it to you very quickly. After the peace agreement had been signed at Saint-Germain on September 10, 1919, Austria received some credits from the West, and the government thus had some new financial flexibility. Characteristically, as you imagine, the foreign credits were used to buy food for Vienna's inactive proletarian masses, the favorite clientele of the government. And many Austrians already started counting on more Western help and concessions in the future. Mises spoke out against the childish notion that foreign capitalists and governments could have any long-term interest in financing a ruinous socialist experiment in Vienna. Now, he was clearly wrong about this because, well, because Argentina. Mises spoke out against the childish notion that foreign capitalists and governments could have any... Well, I said this. One public event of this phase... a conference on Austria's currency problems organized by the Vienna Association of Commerce and Industry gives a good taste of this of his alternative program. So there he spoke with his friend Rosenberg. And the latter explained that foreign exchange controls and banking regulations had stopped the inflow of badly needed foreign credit and encouraged costly barter and black market exchanges. Then Mises observed that at the very moment of his speech, strikes and reductions of working time were omnipresent in Austria. The only exception was the printing press of Austria's central bank, which worked day and night. If this state of affairs continued to exist, the Kronen notes would soon become worthless, their circulation would break down, and anarchy would ensue. Mises had explained the origins of the present mess. On the one hand, the government itself had created the inflation. On the other hand, it had taken the ensuing price rises as a pretext for imposing price controls and many more interventions. So you see, nothing has changed. Thus, while it had formerly led the much despised life of a night watchman, it now felt it had to prove its efficiency through regulations of sauerkraut production. As in ancient Rome, the Austrian government was now at the point of providing the means of sustenance for the majority of the metropolitan population. Hoping on further extensions of allied concessions was futile. After all, the reparations commissions had not been created to provide reparations to Austria. The way out was through balancing the government's budget. Mises was, however, completely disillusioned by this time, about the government's capacity to solve the pressing problems that threatened to bring chaos and anarchy. It had taken him time to learn this lesson, but he had learned it very quickly after all. overcoming his own prejudices about how a thorough monetary reform should be enacted. He had developed a revolutionary private enterprise strategy for the establishment of sound money and was resolved to treat these entirely new paths without delay. Now, that's really an interesting thing. The fundamental paradigm shift at the heart of the Mises plan was to simply ignore the government and to make the reform of the monetary system an affair of the country's principal bankers, merchants, and industrialists. At some point in the fall of 1919, Mises sent these persons a confidential memorandum. He argued that there was an imminent danger that the inflation of the plummeting Kronen exchange rate would incite people to give up on using Kronen banknotes and that it was necessary to prepare for this day. He went on, now that's a quote, "One can hardly expect the government to make these preparations. It is not likely that the financial administration, which for 5 years now has not only followed but also again and again sought to defend the unbecoming inflation policy, and which in complete ignorance of the sole source of the decreasing value of money has accelerated the decline of the krona, that this financial administration suddenly changes its mind. Those of its executives who correctly saw the economic connections have to the present day been unable to overcome the tradition prevailing in their house. The citizens must seek to achieve by their own forces what the government fails to do. All one can hope for from the side of the government is that it not hamper the initiative of the privates. Step aside. It is the duty of the banks, and with the banks, the duty of the big corporations in industry and trade, to prepare the measures that seem to be necessary to overcome the catastrophic consequences of the collapse of the country currency. This is in their own interest and also a service to society as a whole." Mises then went into the details of his plan. He proposed to take measures facilitating the replacement of the krona by a foreign currency. If the inflationary process would go on sufficiently slowly, he argued, no such measures would be necessary. The krona would then be replaced in a continuous process without threatening a disruption of business operations. The danger lay exclusively in the scenario of a sudden collapse that would leave the citizens without money. In this case, disruption could ensue and lead to misery and violence. It was in anticipation of this case alone, therefore, that he urged the Austrian entrepreneurs to seek to obtain a credit of 30 million Swiss francs that could be used for the payment of 1 month's worth of wages and for retail payments. Moreover, it was of utmost importance that this sum be available in very small denominations, lest it be useless for the man on the street. The Austrian banks should therefore plan to issue small sum banknotes denominated in Swiss francs. I can tell you, this is a very exciting document where he states this memorandum, because we all know Mises as a grand theoretician, and sometimes the arguments get pretty abstract. But here he really goes into detail and almost like a military plan, boils it down to the individual measure to be taken. Of course, Austrian law did not allow this, but in the emergency scenario underlying the Mises plan, these legal considerations would be secondary. And he urged his readers not to despair about the possibility that this scenario become reality, but to see it as an opportunity for political improvement. Now, what he says now is also relevant for the present situation. Political ideas that have dominated the minds for decades cannot be refuted through rational arguments. They must run their course in life and cannot collapse otherwise than in great catastrophes. One has to accept the catastrophic devaluation of our currency as a fate. Imperialist and militarist policy necessarily goes in hand with inflationism. A consequent policy of socializations necessarily leads to a complete collapse of the monetary order. The proof is delivered not only through the history of the French Revolution, but also through the present events in Bolshevist Russia and a couple of other states that more or less imitate the Russian example, even though they do not display the atrocious brutality of the Jacobins and Bolsheviks, but prefer less bloody methods instead. In this case, he was referring to his own government. As unbecoming as the collapse of the currency is in its consequences, it has the liberating effect to destroy the system that brings it about. The collapse of the assignats was the kiss of death for the Jacobin policy and marked the beginning of a new policy. In our country, too, a decisive change of economic policy would take its departure from the collapse of the currency. Now, I can only hope for the U.S. that we can avoid this sequence of events? 5 minutes. Good. Simon, time. Now, act number three. So you see, again, this time Mises has become much more radical already than in the Ukrainian example, right? So he said, just ignore the government and let's do it on our own. To reform the fundamental institutions of our economy, we do not need these guys. And I would say, well, that's definitely a modern approach. Now we spring to the year 1931. The meltdown of the New York Stock Exchange in October 29 had sent shockwaves through the world economy. The extent of the damage was, however, not visible from the outset. It soon turned out that Central Europe's economy was particularly affected because the previous policies of the Roaring Twenties had bureaucratized the economy through the multiplication of public firms and through regulations that stifled private entrepreneurs' ability to cope with major changes in their business environment. In the 5 boom years before October 1929, the economy of Germany and Austria had come to rely increasingly on public expenditure, financed through a steady stream of U.S. credits. Murray Rothbard describes this in his book, America's Great Depression. The principal actors in this process were not the federal governments, but the second-level authorities. In Germany, the Länder, as Austria is the same expression, the Länder, the German lands and the Austrian lands, and the cities. Loyal to the prevailing socialist ideology of the time, the mayors of the cities had seized any opportunity to communalize firms of some public interest, in particular in the field of transport and public utilities. Invariably, the performance of these firms under the new public management dropped abysmally. U.S. credits thus played a vital role in compensating for the reduction of productivity. When the crisis broke out, it very quickly became obvious that the crippled remnants of the market economy were unable to bring about fast improvements. Stock market plummeted in Europe too, and within a year reached an all-time low. In November 1930, Mises wrote to his friend, the sociologist Walter Sulzbach at Frankfurt, "I believe that you in Frankfurt do not fully grasp the extent of our Austrian calamity. Maybe you will have a better idea of conditions here if I tell you that on October 31st, that is the day before he wrote, the total value of the Vienna Stock Exchange, except for banks and insurances, was 700 million shillings, which corresponded at that time to $100 million, the entire value of the stock exchange. We in Austria do not have to wait, therefore, for the Third Reich to lead us into decline." Unfortunately, things become less pleasant every day. As usual in such situations, all kinds of real or self-appointed experts advertised their plans to solve the crisis. Given the status political mentality of the late 1920s, which, by the way, differed only in rhetorical favor, but not substantially from our days, these plans invariably involved increased government intervention. The great panacea was, of course, meddling with the gold standard. Several cranks sent Mises their economic and monetary analysis, and in particular their reform proposals. None of them had actually studied any of Mises' writings or monetary economics in general. They were just intelligent laypeople, engineers, doctors, etc., who were full of good intentions. They sought to fix the economic problems of the day by some smart invention and wrote to Mises, who, as a renowned expert on money, could give leverage to their ideas. One of them actually proposed an electricity currency. Mises usually replied to these proposals, and in one case even said he would welcome a publication of the gentleman's proposals, since the discussion of them would be instructive. He always thought that discussing errors might instruct the public, and help to bring about a solution to the present monetary problems. Now, what were his own views on the causes of the present calamity in 1931? He summarizes them in a small booklet, title of The Causes of the Economic Crisis, which is available, among other things, on the Mises Institute website. Here Mises argued that on the unhampered market, unemployment could only be a temporary phenomenon. There was, he said, probably always a certain number of job seekers, just as on the unhampered housing market, there are always uninhabited apartments and apartment seekers. In modern parlance, Mises argued that due to search costs, there was something as natural unemployment. See, nothing new under the sun. Except for this natural residue, however, the market cleared at a market wage rate under the impact of competitive demand and competitive supply. He said, now this self-regulation of the market is strongly obstructed through the intervention of the labor unions acting under the protection and with the support of government power. The labor unions seek to establish the wage rates of their members at higher than market rates. And this goal the unions pursue by the use of violence. Very bluntly put. So Mises said, unemployment as a permanent and mass phenomenon results from the labor union policy of pushing up wage rates. Without unemployment relief, this policy would long since have collapsed. Unemployment relief is therefore not, as misguided public opinion assumes, a measure to alleviate emergencies caused by unemployment. To the contrary, it is an element in the chain of causes that create unemployment as a permanent and mass phenomenon in the first place. The economic calamity, in turn, accentuates political antagonism within the states and between states, spurring the propagation of another round of destructive policies. How to break out of this vicious cycle? Circle. Mises argued that, ultimately, there was no choice but to abolish all government interventions and to confront union power head-on. The longer this confrontation were delayed, for example, through inflation, the more capital would be consumed, which in turn entailed ever-decreasing wages and living standards. The confrontation, therefore, better be sooner rather than later. In particular, it would be a grievous mistake to try to avoid the confrontation with the help of inflation. It had been demonstrated countless times that inflation does not and cannot entail a general improvement of business conditions. Still, this idea enjoyed great popularity. Mises wrote some months after publication of this booklet to a friend in Paris, saying, "Today the entire world, with the exception of one or two dozens of reasonable people, perfectly agrees on two points. Debt should not be paid, and the economy should be stimulated through strong inflation." Now, if you keep this in mind, I mean, what were the circles in which Mises socialized? Only people of great influence politically, in particular on monetary policies. And now he says, with the exception of one or two dozens, all the rest agreed that debts should not be paid and that the economy should be stimulated through inflation. Saying this at the beginning of 1932 means that, well, so we can understand why Keynes swept the landscape, right? Everybody agreed on this, and what Keynes just did was, well, to give some intellectualized justification for what everybody wanted to do in the first place. Some economists, Mises noticed, had, however, come up with a genuinely new theory of how inflation could be beneficial. These economists knew full well that unemployment resulted from excessive wage rates, but rather than confronting the unions with the demand to stop their harmful practices, they, so to say, suggest to cheat the unions, he said. Mises explained the argument and its error. He said, they imagine that in the next inflation, nominal wage rates shall not be changed, which would be equivalent to a reduction of real wage rates. But this blithely assumes that in the next boom, the unions will not demand further wage increases, but quietly contemplate a reduction of real wages. It is indeed not reasonable to expect such union behavior. Mises' refutation of the new pro-inflation argument was nothing but common sense. By the way, also you see, well, this is an old thing, right? It was advanced at the beginning of the 1930s, at least in German economics, and was sold as a big new thing in the 1950s in the U.S. This was just a common sense refutation, but in the heated atmosphere of the early 1930s, with growing economic problems and a ruling statist ideology presenting government action as a panacea for all problems, these views were highly unpopular. As one reviewer of Mises' booklet explained, the labor unions have become so powerful and such an important political factor in state and public opinion that nobody ventures to tell the truth. Neither the journals, which seek to avoid the reproach of asocial feelings, nor the government, which is afraid of becoming unpopular and of being exposed to the unfettered demagogy of all those parties that, not surprisingly, attract the masses with their bellicose cries against any reduction of wages. In short, the abominable plague of political correctness did not appear only at the end of the 20th century. Some of Mises' critics, who otherwise had nothing good to say, could, however, not help but admire his courageous stance faced to overwhelming opposition. One socialist by the name of Eugen Altschul, nobody knows him today, of course, anymore, while calling Mises one of the most extreme representatives of liberalism, admitted that he was unafraid to argue consistently. Imagine that. So it's totally fine. Yeah? He's not afraid to draw the conclusions. And another reviewer pointed out that the Vienna professor Mises, who has been called the last knight of liberalism, fights indefatigably against government intervention in the market process. Now we'll jump to the very last thing. So then I go through some other vicious reactions that are not worth the ink to tell you now. But even well-informed economists criticized Mises' argument that in an unhampered economy, nothing prevents the clearing of markets through price adjustments. Erich Carrel was a well-known economist of the 1940s, 1950s in Germany, argued that, in fact, each change of demand and supply would induce cumulative Wechselian effects that amplified the initial disequilibrium. And Wilhelm Röpke argued, in the present phase of the crisis, so that's a quote from Röpke, in the present phase of the crisis, it seems to me it is wrong to expect that a reduction of the level of wages would re-establish equilibrium. This is wrong because, given the total paralysis of investment, each reduction of prices and incomes would lead to a continued sterilization of means of payment in the form of an increase of the liquidity of the banking system and thus to an extended disequilibrium. Mises and his fellow travelers apparently do not sufficiently take account of the fact that today we have monstrous productive reserves that are unused. In other words, we have a gigantic capital surplus that requires credit expansion to become visible. For this reason, it is not correct that government investment would deprive the private economy of its means. The paradoxical fact, Röpke says, which cannot be grasped on the basis of purely static ideas, is that the means of the private economy would thereby be multiplied. So, government inflation does not take away means from the private economy, but multiplies as the horn of plenty for the private economy. And with this quote, I can leave you because you now know why this is not the Wilhelm Röpke Institute.
Thank you very much, Guido. I've heard a lot of stories about Mises' courage, but those are some new ones on me, too. We're going to break at this point, go back downstairs for...